The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is How I Became a Mother Without Having Children. Why one woman skipped the dirty work of parenting and embraced the powerful African tradition of other mothering, pouring love and energy into other people's kids. When I left my home state of Ohio in my mid-20s, newly divorced and bursting with enthusiasm to chase my dreams, babysitting was not on my list of avenues to success. But because I'd been watching other people's children since I was still a child myself, I was uniquely qualified to work as a sitter and then a nanny as I established myself. Parents always need babysitters, and I was really good at it. I first landed in Washington, D.C., where weekend babysitting was just another way to supplement my income at the mostly low-paying jobs I secured. By the time I moved to New York City 3 years later, my main source of income came from being a nanny to the children of wealthy New Yorkers, while I worked on building a business and engaging in my activism activities on the side. I quickly discovered that the things I loved about children were rarely rooted in the dirty work of parenting. By dirty work, I mean the daily labor, the types of things that interrupt your sleep, skew your schedule, or direct all your efforts towards the needs and wants of one tiny human. Not only was it utterly unappealing to me, but it seemed to trigger something deeper than just my desire to sleep in or have more quiet time for myself. It turns out that what made me good at nannying was the same thing that made me move away from the idea of becoming a parent. I had spent too much of my life in a caretaker role, caring for my mother and my sister's children when I was still young enough to need my own mothering. A study put out in 2018 by the National Institute on Child Health titled Views of Teenage Children About the Effects of a Parent's Mobility Disability speaks to my experience of growing up with a disabled parent. Several participants reported feeling more mature than their peers or bearing more responsibility because of their parents' disability, the authors wrote. Most notably, when a parent has an ongoing progression of an existing disability or acute complications related to disability, youth may be at risk of feeling vulnerable, especially if they live with a single parent. My mother had contracted polio at age 5 and was unable to walk without crutches. The effects of being born to a disabled parent were compounded for me when I supported my mother in raising her grandchildren and, again, when I chose an early career as a child care provider. I was both highly skilled in and completely exhausted from caretaking. And so I asked myself, how much of my physical, mental, and emotional capacity do I have left to pour into another human in such a large way? The answer was not enough. Much of what I value, solitude, spontaneity, independence, would largely be suspended if I became a mom. I enjoy slow, quiet mornings. I like long walks and late nights for work and pleasure. I love a tidy house and neutral colors. None of this screams mom material. But I didn't settle for just a cons column. I also got thoughtful about the joys I found in children, like stroking their creativity by paying attention to what they naturally gravitated to, keeping them joyfully distracted while their caretakers took a break, helping them talk through the hard emotions their parents couldn't always attend to, and witnessing their personalities evolve like a miracle. My joy came from being part of the village people reference when they say it takes a village to raise a child. So I began to explore other ways I might find deep purpose in being part of the villages where children were loved, raised, and celebrated. This exploration thrilled me. It gave me space to stand firm in my own desires and remain child-free, yet also the opportunity to indulge in the beauty of family, connection, and intergenerational community. After much honest introspection and observation, I became comfortable with, and even excited by, the notion of being the person who pours her energy into other people's children. I cherish getting to be Auntie Rachel. Motherhood is simply not for me. In recent years, more and more women have been opting out of parenthood. In 2018, according to the U.S. Census, nearly 50% of women in the United States between the ages of 15 and 44 had not given birth, the highest percentage since 1976, the year they started tracking this data. According to the Pew Research Center, nearly 1 in 5 U.S. women will end her childbearing years without bearing a child. White women are most likely to be child-free, but the numbers of Black, Asian, and Hispanic women with no children are also on the rise. Their reasons are varied, including costs, the desire to remain independent, prioritizing a career, or not meeting the right partner to parent with. I must mention that Black people often face an additional factor when deciding whether to have children. As a Black woman who grappled with the decision for several years, I considered what having a child would mean not only for my lifestyle goals and aspirations, but also for the child. I was deeply fearful of bringing a Black body into this world. My own understanding of the vulnerability and heaviness of existing in Black skin, how white supremacy insists that our lives don't matter, how there is no accountability when our lives are discarded, how I would have to parent a child in a way that included instructions on how to survive whiteness and racism. None of us should have to add fear of losing my child's life at the hands of the state to the list of reasons to be child-free, but we do. Racism distorts every aspect of our lives. When I started looking for a child-free community online, I didn't find much on social media. The few communities I found seemed rooted in a very concerning rhetoric of disliking children or making fun of parents who had made the wrong choice. I couldn't find anywhere that wanted to shine a light on the upsides of our decision and find joy and excitement in being part of the village around us. So I started an online community myself, and I called it Rich Auntie Supreme. The auntie part is an homage to the other mother role, which Black feminist and sociologist Patricia Hill Collins explains, refers to the strong tradition in African diasporic communities where women blood-related or not, aunts, grandmothers, neighbors, best friends, teachers, step in as a maternal influence in body and spirit, as a physical presence, and an emotional backbone. The auntie or other mother role is an intentional and sacred one. Across time and space, other mothering has been a life-saving aspect of our community. When mothers could not care for their own children, other mothers housed, fed, bathed, and loved them, ensuring their literal survival. Today, aunties and other mothers often take on an activist role, educating and supporting Black children and teens in a community effort to fortify them against a world of whiteness. Collins writes that community other mothering brings people along so that the vulnerable members of the Black community will be able to attain the self-reliance and independence essential for resistance. The rich and supreme parts of my community's name signal that a child-free existence can be just that, supremely rich, rich with time, rest, spontaneity, and reward. The name points to a lifestyle that gives birth to joy, abundance, and possibility, rather than one lacking in some way just because we aren't mothers. After all, the decision is not to be whispered in shame, but to be lived out loud with the same pride with which one expresses other big decisions, such as getting a new job or becoming engaged or having a baby. This next article is from the wellness section, How I Breathed My Way Through the Indignities of Being a Black Woman in Corporate America. Author Z. Clark is living proof that a mindful breathing practice can help anyone, especially people of color, transcend moments of rage, fear, and exhaustion. Z. Clark is acutely aware of something many Black people in the United States have learned the hard way. that while your title and alma mater may look perfect on paper, they can't shield you from microaggressions. She holds degrees from both Harvard College and Harvard Business School and has managed teams at Silicon Valley startups and Fortune 500 companies for decades. But she has also struggled with the isolation of being the only black female in a sea of hundreds of employees, and weathered high-stakes work demands that sent her stress levels off the charts. Ring a bell? Whether your manager's racial comment catches you off guard, or the police are humiliating you in a grocery store parking lot, both have happened to Clark. You need to find ways to protect your body and mind. She relies on breathwork, a practice she learned in India in 2017 after quitting her corporate job. Today, the New Mexico resident and mindfulness and breathwork teacher is the CEO of Reclaiming Flow, an organization that teaches workshops for people of color on topics like managing microaggressions, imposter syndrome, and stress management. She has also written the book Black People Breathe, a guide of illustrated breathwork exercises for people of color dealing with the troubling impacts of racism, including hearing about events in the news, and for allies who want to provide support. We asked Clark how intentional breathing transformed her life and how anyone can benefit. You were a corporate powerhouse. What made you leave it all and eventually start your own business and write this book? If I were to sum it up in one word, burnout. I was usually the only black person wherever I was, especially when I rose in the ranks. And microaggressions are real. People would say things that would trigger me significantly, and I felt like, as the only black person, I needed to represent the entire black race. I felt like I needed to work twice as hard just to be treated like everyone else. I was working nights and weekends, which ultimately started to affect my physical and mental health. My doctors were like, "Something's got to change, especially around your stress levels." So that's when I took it to heart, when it started to put my health at risk. And that's when I quit and went to India, where I discovered breath work. What made you think, "This is my calling"? I was training to be a yoga teacher, and a breathwork intensive was part of the training. What I love about it is that you can do it anytime, anywhere. You don't need to take a class or make an appointment, and it's so helpful in the moment when you're feeling extreme emotions. And also, it's free. I thought black people need this. There's a lot of media around black people and therapy. I'm a strong believer in it, but also know that it's expensive. I'm not saying that breath work is a replacement for therapy, but I love that anyone can do it. You write about so many harrowing moments, like being the only black woman out of more than 500 employees while working in enterprise sales. Could you tell us more and walk us through the breath work you practiced for relief? People would say offensive things like, "When I see you, I don't see color." One boss pulled me aside during my first week and said, "I just want you to know that I didn't hire you because you're black." That never crossed my mind until he brought it up. It's so easy to spit out exactly what you're thinking when people trigger you. But you might get fired. It might ruin your personal brand at work, your interpersonal relationships, and your ability to collaborate. So I found the extra long exhalation to be extremely powerful because they don't know what you're doing, because they don't know that you're doing it. Exhaling stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system. Another thing that happens a lot? I teach workshops to leading companies around the country and ask the black employees, which of these microaggressions have you experienced? At one of them, a big company whose products people use every day, 100% of the people said they'd experienced this. People ignoring their comment and then someone else saying the exact same thing in the meeting and being applauded for it. In those situations, you can do an extra long exhalation or a belly breath, and it's not just at work, but I use that one with the police as well, anytime you're triggered. During a belly breath, you inhale, and you allow your belly to expand like a balloon, then exhale, and your belly comes towards your spine. It's counterintuitive because we're taught in American society to suck it in and look skinny. But when you inhale and you actually make your belly big, it stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest nervous system, allowing you to respond from your highest self. It's a pause between stimulus and response. In your book, you describe an incident you had with police at a grocery store. Can you share a little about that? I spent $220 at a grocery store while on a cross-country road trip. I was in the parking lot putting the groceries in my car, which was kind of full because I was on a camping trip through national parks, when I heard police sirens. That's when they came. Police cars. The men looking very aggressive and scary. They were also very tall. I'm 5'2 and a half, so it's very intimidating when large men are yelling at you. They were like, "Ma'am, where's the groceries? Where are the groceries? Did you purchase those groceries?" And I was like, "Yes, here's the receipt." Then I walked them through every vegetable on the receipt, and they insisted that I stole deli meat, but I'm a vegan. They went through all the items on the receipt and all the groceries in the bag, but weren't satisfied and didn't believe me. So I grew more frustrated and angry inside, but was also scared because I didn't know what they were going to do to me. Then they started searching all the bags in my car, my clothes, my sleeping bag. Everything was all over the concrete, and they still didn't believe me. I was so scared, but also so pissed. You hear stories about when people say what they think to the police, and the next thing you know, and even black women, right? There are a lot of stories about black men, but in the last few years, there have been more black women. You don't know what they're going to do to you. So I took a deep belly breath at that moment. That allowed me to calm down so I could put on my best code-switching voice and try to make nice conversation and be as sweet and non-threatening as possible. What's the most important thing you hope readers take away from this book? I have two, depending on the audience. For black people and other people of color, we have the power to control how we're feeling inside, regardless of what's going on around us. For allies and aspiring ones, I want them to be aware of the realities that happen in this country so they will be inspired to be better, to speak up when they see these things happening, and help amplify black voices because we're often invisible. Is there any one more breathing technique you'd like to share with our readers? A good one for when you're tired is the bellows breath. Have loose fists at your shoulders. As you inhale, shoot your arms up with a loud, audible inhalation. Then you bring your arms down as you exhale. It's fast. It goes like this. Inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. Do that for a few rounds. I suggest starting with 10, then increasing. I teach these in my workshops to black and brown employees across the country. As black people, we often do more work than others. We get extra responsibilities. My jobs weren't specifically diversity, equity, and inclusion, but I was in all these HR meetings that weren't part of my job. I would say yes to all of it, which was exhausting. That's when the bellows breath can help you get some energy, because there's only so much coffee you can drink in a day. Hey, this is in the relationship section. What happens when an atheist has a mystical experience? She's an investor, a founder, an author, and a speaker who no longer believes in a God. But there remain moments she's had to be open to, including these. I was raised Jehovah's Witness. I used to think atheists were sinners and going to hell. I was afraid of them and afraid for them. My whole family is of faith in some way, but I'm not going to church anymore. Now I'm someone who is staunchly settled in my beliefs, or lack thereof. I remain curious and open to being proven wrong, however. A few months ago, I started a podcast to have open and honest conversations with people from all walks of life and various degrees of faith. I wondered if my preconceived notions might be debunked or simply reconfirmed. During one conversation, I was reminded of a mystical experience I had years ago. I was in my early 20s. A friend I'd grown up with had passed away at 18 from a heart problem and nobody knew about. She had just given birth. Her baby was a month old. She was walking around the baby's crib and dropped to the floor. At that time, my friend had braids, a young black woman with braids. Fast forward a little bit, just a few years later, and I'm staying at their house, talking to her young daughter. She's pointing to a photo of her mother, saying, "That's Mama." It's hard to describe, but my friend's daughter had never been shown a picture of her mother with braids. She had only seen photos with short hair, a very different look to a three-year-old. I said, "Wait, who is that?" And she said again, "That's Mama." So that was a surprise. Then, for as long as I live, I'll never forget what happened next. As I was leaving and closing the front door, I looked up at the stairs, and my friend was there, with her braids looking down at me. She wasn't fully flesh, but she was there. I got in the car and didn't say a word to anybody. First of all, I was thinking with my critical eye. I had to ask if maybe it was mind games. Was it my brain wanting that? I want to put it out there that it could be that. But the thing is, if it wasn't my mind, then I saw what I actually saw. That's an interesting moment, right? My religious life is over, but then I see that. Part of me thinks my friend must see her daughter and be with her, looking the way she did when she passed. And her daughter must have seen her mother. That's why she knew it was her in the photo. I now think it is as simple as energy of a person, and they're not necessarily done. Yes, they're somewhere else. Their vessel was for 80 years, or 18 years in some unfortunate cases. But their spirit lives on. They're not walking around with us, but they're doing something, or moving things out of the way. And maybe that's God. Maybe it's a culmination of spirits, past and present. I say this because that wasn't my only unexplained moment. My mother's mother, Mrs. Ida May Butler, passed away when I was young. I haven't attended funerals since seeing a teenager's open casket traumatized me, so I stayed at the family house during the ceremony. While I was there, the windows in my grandmother's room started to shake violently. There was no wind that I could see, and no other window shook. Needless to say, I sat outside for the remainder of the morning. I don't believe for one second that my grandmother was trying to scare me, but I do think she may have been trying to tell me something, or let herself be known. Even at 42, reconciling these two events as an atheist, moments I experienced and images I saw with my own eyes is confounding. They alone are not enough to convince me to change what I believe to be true, but they are part of what keeps me curious and open-minded. And thus, I suspect that my journey of demystifying faith will be a long-term, yet worthwhile trek. Next article is entitled, "Friends Who Hallucinate Together Stay Together. No Drugs Required. A Virtual Breathwork Gathering Replaced Margaritas and Facials with Happy Tears and Transcendence. Welcome to the new girls' trip." New Year's Day, 2021. How to ring in a new year with my closest friends, some of whom were thousands of miles away? One by one, we appeared in the Zoom meeting, waiting room of my yoga teacher, and tearful at the sight of one another. "So, Mulke has brought you together to do breath work," said Allison Sinatra, from whom I'd been taking yoga in Woodstock, New York, for 20 years. She'd stopped using my first name around 2010. "Have any of you done breath work before?" We all shook our heads no. When Allison had mentioned during her weekly online yoga class that she was offering virtual breath work sessions, I flashed back to all the energy-shifting breathing exercises she'd led me through over the years and thought it could be nice to gift my friends a relaxing, re-centering experience for the new year, a soothing time out from the nonstop madness and confusion of the world. "Okay, ladies, so you're going to lie on your back on the floor, no pillow under your neck, and breathe like this." She opened her mouth and took two staccato inhales, then audibly sighed them out as though she'd been surprised, then quickly relieved. She told us to try it. It didn't feel natural or relaxing. "Great. Now you're to repeat that breath cycle without pausing for 30 minutes while I play some music and guide you. I unmuted. Wait, what? My friends laughed nervously. Allison told us to go at our own pace. Faster, sharper breathing, dialing up the intensity and therefore release, and let us know that our hands might tense into lobster claws. The most important thing was to allow our emotions to emerge, be it grief for what we'd lost through the pandemic, anger, love, or everything all at once. This, it turns out, was holotropic breathwork. The therapeutic technique was developed by the LSD researchers Stanislav and Christina Grof in the 1970s after the hallucinogenic was banned, with the goal of helping people achieve altered states of consciousness that allow for emotional release and healing. The name translates from the Greek as moving towards wholeness. It has been used to relieve depression, substance abuse, and PTSD, as well as to boost self-growth and relaxation. As I lay there trying to figure out the challenging rhythm, I panicked about what I'd gotten everyone into. Would they call for a Woodstock intervention? In my crew, I was the furthest into spirituality, and I had dipped in deeper as I sought solace from single parenting and remote schooling while grappling with work loss and terminal illness in my family. 10 panicked minutes later, a switch flipped. Suddenly, my breath was guiding me, placing me onto waves of emotions. Since I was alone and the camera and microphone were off, I could let out loud new sounds. Soon I was crying, then screaming as forcefully as I had during childbirth, finally able to give voice to all the grief and fear I'd buried. Then came a surge of love and gratitude for my friends, my family, this crazy world, even myself. I had miraculously overridden my thoughts and emerged into pure feeling. It was a wild and cathartic ride, tripping on a hallucinogenic made of nothing but air. Allison guided us back onto the planet, and we turned our cameras back on. To my surprise, we were all crying, thanking Allison and feeling more connected to each other and to ourselves. It felt like the best gift I could have given. Since then, I've gifted Allison's virtual sessions to friends who were navigating a difficult time, and recently honored the anniversary of my father's death with his girlfriend of 30 years. I tried it in person at Frequency Breathwork a few times, then found myself on the floor at Bergdorf Goodman, where La Double J's glamorous founder, J.J. Martin, hosted a breathwork breakfast for fashion editors and influencers, led by Allison. How would they react? Once again, when Allison brought us back upright, the women tearfully shared their surprise and gratitude for the powerful, if initially terrifying, experience. For me, breathwork has never been easy, and it's never been less than transformative. It has helped me to release sadness and fear, and to do deeper work on self-acceptance that therapy just can't access. At its best, it feels like I'm blasting through concrete to forge new pathways. And hearing people share what they want to work through has made me realize that however different or perfect others may appear, we all have remarkable, similar fears and longings to be loved and whole. Breathwork has been a gift, one that I want to keep sharing. We're going to take a look in the food section. Try Oprah's favorite pizza recipe with a healthy-ish twist, and find out why she calls it the best pizza she ever remembers having. It's a truth universally acknowledged that pizza is one of the most delicious foods in the world, full stop. And now Oprah has discovered the secret sauce to one of the best pizza recipes ever, thanks to French chef Philippe Chevalier, who famously created Oprah's favorite pasta recipe, which eschews butter for a more surprising ingredient. This time, Chef Chevalier made Oprah a pizza that was so delicious, she asked him to make the exact same recipe the next night. He made me a pizza that was, I have to say it, the best pizza that I ever remember having, Oprah says. Now Oprah knows the idea of a best pizza can be divisive, so she's clarifying that she asked specifically for a spinach pizza. There are all kinds of pizzas in the world. I know everybody's going to debate what's the best pizza. I'm just talking about what was for me, she explains. The secret is literally in the sauce. Rather than starting with a tomato-based layer, this pizza sauce uses what Chef Chevalier calls Florentine sauce. Basically, it begins with a standard bechamel, a creamy white sauce that's the base for many French dishes. Then, Chef Chevalier blends in a mixture of sautéed spinach, herbs, and garlic. I just wanted to share the recipe with those of you who actually know how to do this, Oprah says. Merci to you, she adds to Chef Chevalier. Merci and have mercy. On the line, you can hear Oprah talk about the recipe with Chef Chevalier, and then I'm going to list the full recipe below for the Florentine spinach pizza. For the dough, 290 grams of warm water, about 1 1/4 cups, 1 pinch granulated sugar, 1/2 tablespoon of dry yeast, 400 grams 00 flour, it's about 3 1/4 cups. It says try something like King Arthur Neapolitan style flour, and 1 1/2 teaspoons of sea salt. For the sauce, 700 ml or milligrams of whole milk, about 3 cups, 40 grams unsalted butter, that's about 3 tablespoons, 40 grams of all-purpose flour, that's about 5 tablespoons, salted pepper, grated nutmeg, 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, 2 garlic cloves sliced, 2 tablespoons Italian parsley chopped, 1 teaspoon of fresh thyme chopped, and 1 1/2 bunches of fresh spinach. For the pizza toppings, 85 grams fresh goat cheese, about 1/4 cup or 3 ounces, 85 grams of Gruyere cheese, grated, about 1/4 cup or 3 ounces, 1 handful of fresh baby spinach, 2 Spanish onions or sweet white onions thinly sliced, pine nuts, 1/2 teaspoon of chili flakes or crushed red pepper, and lemon vinaigrette. So here are the directions for the dough. In a bowl, whisk together the warm water, sugar, and yeast. Set aside and let sit for 15 minutes. Number 2. In a separate bowl, mix 00 flour with sea salt. Add water mixture to flour and combine until a doughy texture forms. Number 3, let the dough rise at room temperature, covered for 30 minutes. Knead the dough into a smooth ball and place in a bowl, cover, and let sit in the fridge for 24 hours. Alternatively, you can skip these steps and buy pre-made pizza dough. For the sauce, in a saucepan, bring the milk to a boil and set aside. In a saucepan over medium heat, melt the butter, add the flour, and whisk until combined. Number 3, while continuing to whisk, slowly pour the milk into the pan, doing so in 3 portions. Continue cooking on low heat for 10 minutes until a creamy bechamel sauce forms. Remove from the heat and season with salt, pepper, and nutmeg to taste. Number 4, in a sauté pan over medium heat, add the olive oil. Add the garlic, parsley, thyme, and spinach. Season with salt and pepper to taste, and cook until the spinach begins to wilt, about 2 minutes. Number 5, in a food processor, combine the bechamel sauce and sautéed spinach, mix until a smooth, creamy texture forms, let cool. Now to assemble the pizza. Preheat oven to 500 degrees. You can also use a pizza oven. We recommend Oprah's choice, the Solo Stove Pie Oven, and pie is spelled just P-I, which was featured in her 2022 favorite things. Number 2, cut the dough in half and roll each portion into circles about 18 to 20 inches in diameter and 1/4 to 1/2 inch thick. Number 3, place dough on a pizza stone. Spread sauce on dough and then add goat cheese and Gruyere, top with enough spinach to cover the entire pizza. Number 4, cook pizza until the dough is crispy. Number 5, after cooking, garnish with fresh spinach, onions, pine nuts, and chili flakes as desired. Drizzle with lemon vinaigrette. Serve while hot. We're in TV and movies, and this article is entitled Padma Lakshmi on How Food Can Unite Us. If you can break bread with someone, then you already have common ground. Pastelas in Puerto Rico, Italian pizza in New York City, Nigerian fufu in Houston, authentic Greek gyros in Tarpon Springs, Florida. These are just a few of the mouth-watering foods cookbook author, top chef, host, and model Padma Lakshmi enjoys with immigrants across America in season 2 of Taste the Nation. She's also an executive producer on the show, which is now streaming on Hulu. Each time she pulls up a seat, hypothetically or literally, she shows how food helps us understand each other better, despite our differences. She also explores the concept of American identity while amplifying issues of critical importance to various communities living within the United States. I wanted to show people that immigrants built this country, that they're interesting, that they're worthy of attention and love, and that they are what makes this country what it is, Lakshmi tells Oprah Daily. Below, she shares more about the show and how food can unite. You came to the U.S. from India at age 4. How has being an immigrant influenced your love of food? Being an immigrant is a big part of why I work in food today. I struggled with eating when I first got to this country because I grew up as a vegetarian. And being in America in the 70s, there wasn't a lot of vegetarian food. So at first, I would only be able to eat at Mexican restaurants or Chinese restaurants because I always knew that they had rice. When I was young, my mother and I would go to Spanish Harlem to get sugarcane or cilantro or tamarind because there wasn't really that big of an Indian section. It was in Queens and we lived in Manhattan. And then we would go to Chinatown to buy Asian vegetables because those were the vegetables my mother would use for cooking for her and me. And so, by hunting and gathering for spices and ingredients that were in Indian cuisine, we got to experience Puerto Rican food, Dominican food, Chinese food, and Thai food. So it naturally made me more curious. What makes Taste the Nation different from other food shows you've worked on? Taste the Nation uses food as a jumping-off point, or as a vehicle, to go into deeper issues that affect our culture, family, economics, political views, art, literature, music. It delves into every aspect of a particular community's culture. And it seeks to understand that community as deeply and as well as is possible. The food is just what gets us in. But it's really a show that's very political. In fact, the title, Taste the Nation, is a play on words of the weekend morning political show, Face the Nation. I wanted to show people that immigrants built this country, that they're interesting, that they're worthy of attention and love, and that they are what makes this country what it is. You say in season 1 that the gateway to another culture often happens first through food. As you head into season 2, how are you further adding to that message? We do it by example. We do it by showing how easy it is to learn about another culture through their food. If you can break bread with someone, then you already have common ground. And it also becomes a metaphor for understanding so much else. For instance, in the Puerto Rican episode, you know we posed this question at the beginning. Ketchup or no ketchup? There's a wonderful Puerto Rican dish called pasteles. They're like tamales, but made with root vegetables rather than corn or masa. And some people swear that you can only eat pasteles with ketchup. Other people wouldn't be caught dead putting ketchup on their pasteles. And it becomes a metaphor for what that particular community and island is going through. Because Puerto Ricans are not immigrants, they are American because Puerto Rico is a territory of America. So, in a way, they have been colonized by American culture. They are the last American colony. We don't think of them that way, but they are. They've also had to pay the price for what that entails. It's more expensive to buy fresh fruit and vegetables in Puerto Rico than it is in most of the U.S. mainland. And they're suffering from being a territory. We talk about a lot of those very serious, deep issues that affect everyone on that island. What do you hope viewers take away from season 2 of this show? I hope they take away a curiosity about other cultures that they live among. So if you have a neighbor from a different background than you, that you'll go up to them and say, "Hi, how are you? Would you like to come for tea?" And get to know your fellow Americans, who may seem different from you, but probably have a lot in common with you as well. We're in the books section now, and this article is How My Mom Taught Me to Write with Her Sewing Machine. The author of Borderless shares how a broken appliance brought back memories and gratitude. On a recent unseasonably hot day, my sister and I were enlisted to help to sort through my parents' garage, overflowing with decades' worth of junk. Taking a break from our day jobs, I am a writer, my sister is a college advisor. "Maybe we should just get rid of everything without looking through it," she suggested. Part of me agreed. But then I spotted my mother's old Singer sewing machine, the ivory-colored one with a thick coffee-brown stripe across the top. That familiar silver dial. I stared at it with such intensity that suddenly I was 10 years old, watching my mother sit at the end of the dining room table in front of that Singer. I loved watching as she used her teeth to cut thread and pressed her foot on the black pedal. That machine purred. It was a pair of pants for me, a shirt for my sister, or even curtains that had her full attention. When she hovered over that Singer, squinting at the needle, using her palms to even the fabric, I could tell she was transported to a different world. It was one far from her daily work as a housekeeper for wealthy families in the Boston suburbs, far from the endless responsibilities of being an immigrant wife, mother, daughter, and sister. But, come to think of it, she hadn't sewn in years. "What happened to your new one?" I asked her. I was thinking about the computerized sewing machine with the fancy buttons, a workhorse. It really got the job done. "It's there," my mother said, waving the back of her hand toward the house. As one of the oldest of 7 kids, my mother was the first to move from Guatemala to the United States. It was the 70s, and Guatemala was in the midst of a 36-year-long civil war. But as my mother jokes, the more pressing war was the one between her mother and father. He was an alcoholic and rarely kept a job. The family pinched resources wherever they could. My mother and her sister literally shared one tuition to attend school, my mother attending classes in the morning and rushing home at lunch to hand over her uniform, whose holes she mended, to my aunt, who would attend the afternoon classes. Every evening they would share notes. When my mother turned 18, she left for the United States. She landed in Los Angeles, where she would spend years working as a live-in nanny, sending money home, learning English. Once she was so desperate for her native language that she looked up a completely random Spanish surname in the Yellow Pages and dialed. Mrs. Santiago picked up and spoke to my mother in Spanish for an hour. So homesick was my mother that she contemplated returning to Guatemala, ripping herself like a seam from her new life in America. But when she received a telegram in English with 5 words, "Your father is very ill," she didn't know what "ill" meant, and by the time she could look it up, her father had died. Unable to care for him, she had no choice but to stay and work and support her family back home. As a young woman in the U.S., she grew to love fashion. The round-edged sepia photographs of her during this time showed flirty poses beside palm trees on the boardwalk or on the beach, as she modeled dress after dress, bell-bottom jeans, crop tops, even bikinis. She wore headbands, scarves, and chunky platform heels, With only a needle and thread, she was able to alter and repair, developing her passion that transcended geography, language, culture. She discovered self-expression through clothes and accessories, allowing her to feel beautiful in her new country. Stitch by stitch, she made a life in America. She learned English, saved money, moved across the country to Massachusetts, married my father, became a U.S. citizen, raised three daughters, bought a house. For Christmas, the year she was pregnant with me, she longed for a sewing machine of her own. But at $200, it was too expensive. That spring, when I was born, my mother told my father, "With two girls, I need to sew." He laughed, and together they drove to Sears. They would make it work. With it, she thrived, making her family clothes, hemming jeans, shortening dresses, and adding style to her home by sewing curtains and pillowcases. Stitch by stitch, year after year. Eventually, she even went back to school, earning her GED when I was a freshman in high school. She insisted on borrowing my older sister's cap and gown for photos at the local Sears portrait studio. The gown was too long, so naturally, she hemmed that too. When my sister and I helped our parents clean out the garage, our faces and arms covered in dust and dirt, we assessed each item for its worth. A blender missing its top, toss it. A comforter eaten by moths, toss it. A plastic sled, keep it. My sister pointed at the broken Singer and scrunched her nose. Wait, no, we couldn't. This was my mother's keyboard. Instead of words, sewing was her language and her art. The glint of the needle was her blinking cursor. I stared at that dusty Singer and realized that watching her make the most of what fabric she had been dealt has been the greatest honor of my life. Even though I can't sew, not even a button, it was in watching her at the kitchen table when I sat at the opposite end that I learned to stitch together words, sentence by sentence, page by page. And what is writing if not making something from nothing? In that moment, in the humid garage, my mother and I both lunged toward the machine, reaching for all that it had created, all that it had sewn together. Even though it no longer technically worked, we knew that Singer was staying. Continuing on in books, this next article is called The Stars of Book Club. The next chapter, Share Books That Made a Difference. Candace Bergen, Jane Fonda, and Mary Steenburgen revisit books that left a lasting impact. In 2018, Candace Bergen, Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, and Mary Steenburgen teamed up to star in Book Club, a movie that highlights just how life-changing and inspiring starting a book club with your friends can be. In that movie, the ladies read 50 Shades of Grey, which inspired them to turn up the heat in their love lives and make their next chapter of life the best one yet. Now the ladies are back for a sequel. In Book Club, the next chapter, out now, they're heading to Italy for a girls' trip while reading Paolo Coelho's, and it's C-O-E-L-H-O, The Alchemist. Here, three of the stars, Candace Bergen, Jane Fonda, and Mary Steenburgen, share the books that made a difference in their lives. The Alchemist. After reading the script for Book Club, the next chapter, I read The Alchemist by Paolo Coelho, the book that inspires the ladies in the film throughout their Italian adventure. My favorite part about The Alchemist is the way it slowed my life down and focused me immediately. I love that it took you inside this tiny patch of sand and dissected it and brought you concentration and a focus on the immediate life. I loved the oasis. It was the biggest oasis I ever read about. 300 palm trees. It was impressive. It makes you see that you have to embrace your life and the challenges that come with it. That was Candace Bergen. On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. It's the next book by Naomi Klein, K-L-E-I-N. On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal by Naomi Klein is a book I read in a day. It made up my mind to move to D.C. and engage in weekly nonviolent civil disobedience, which came to be called Fire Drill Fridays. It hit me like a bolt of lightning. That was said by Jane Fonda. The last one is Love in the Time of Cholera. I very much love the book Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. At the time I first read it, I wasn't sure if I would ever know a lasting love in my life. After 30 years of being with my husband, Ted Danson, the book about a long and treasured love is more meaningful. That was by Mary Steenburgen. In Wellness, this article is What to Do When You Have Burnout But Need to Keep Going. If your job is sucking the life out of you, it's time to recalibrate. Here are simple ways to feel and work better. While the Great Resignation of 2022 isn't slowing down, this year's work phenomenon, the Great Layoff, means that burnout is still rampant. And it's a beast, says Christina Maslach, M-A-S-L-A-C-H, Ph.D., a pioneer researcher and leading expert on the topic. Burnout isn't just feeling overwhelmed by work volumes and short deadlines or dealing with boundary-violating slacks and emails on a Saturday morning, though there's a special place in hell for those managers. In 2019, the World Health Organization, WHO, identified three hallmark characteristics that signify this occupational hazard. One is emotional exhaustion. The second is a very increased cynicism, a take-this-job-and-shove-it attitude, says Maslach. And the third is soul-crushing self-doubt when you start to think, what's wrong with me? Why can't I handle this? If you're checking all those boxes, you're not alone. Just last November, 4.2 million people quit their jobs. A recent Gallup report found that employee stress around the world is at an all-time high, and that in the U.S., 3 in 10 employees say they are frequently or always burned out at work. Alas, no meditation app is going to fix this. You can't address an exploitive work environment by telling people to do yoga and drink matcha tea, says Helen Hendrickson, Ph.D., a clinical psychologist at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. It's important to recognize that burnout is a systematic problem. It's not fair to expect an individual to cope and overcome it. Maybe you can't revolutionize the workplace, but you can shift your mindset so you're equipped to survive the rock-bottom moments, regroup, and take action. Here's how. Don't shoulder the blame. People often ask Maslach, a core researcher at the Interdisciplinary Center for Healthy Workplaces at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-author of The Burnout Challenge, if they should go to their supervisor for help when suffering from burnout. She typically says no. You're agreeing that you're the source of the problem, she explains. It's blaming the victim, you, and it means you've got the burden of whatever needs to be improved. Instead, reframe the conversation so it's a we issue, not a me issue. How can we improve the workplace so all of us can thrive and not have to sacrifice our family time, our sleep time? Hit pause when you hit rock bottom. When a streak of deflating days or a particularly demeaning interaction with your boss leaves you in angry tears, a dose of mindfulness can take the edge off, says Hendrickson. How I like to think about it is that your attention is a spotlight and you get to choose where to point it, she says. When we are in really tough emotional situations, we naturally put our spotlight on everything that is bad. We focus on how it feels in our body, how unfair it was that our boss said that, or how dumb we are. Broaden the spotlight, Hendrickson says. Shine it on the positive or neutral things in your life to give yourself some context, which can dilute the horrible things that are going on. Another way to get perspective is to remind yourself that this despair you feel is temporary. I'm not saying it's not important or is invalid, says Hendrickson. Rather, keep in mind that horrible feelings go in and out like the waves on the shore and can dissipate with distance, like after a good night's sleep, a shower, or a sandwich, she says. time gets you to a place where you can take constructive action and make decisions in line with your values. Ease your foot off the pedal. It might feel impossible, but take some time off. Just breaking from your everyday routine helps restore a healthy mindset. Another biggie. Make sure to get enough sleep. Once you're back in the office, taking breaks is crucial. This can be eating a quick lunch away from your desk, or asking a coworker to go grab a coffee, and then discussing the latest royal family drama, or a book you're reading, anything not work-related. Carve in positive moments between all the other stuff, says Moslack. Plus, bonding with colleagues is always smart. You can help each other down the line. When you're not working, shift gears. If you hunch over a computer all day, hit the YMCA for a swim. If you crunch numbers for a living, sign up for ceramics class. If you work at home or alone, schedule regular walks with a friend or drinks with your mom crew. It's about finding social relationships that feel good and give a little more meaning to your life, says Moslack. Find strength in numbers. If you're feeling hopeless and depleted, chances are your coworkers are too. Find a way to connect and rally together. A burnout strategy that focuses on just you may not be as persuasive to a manager or a boss than if 10 people show up and say, "Can we figure out how to do things better so there's less of a burden on us?" suggests Moslack. Rather than storming in with a bunch of complaints or threatening a mass exodus, make it constructive, says Moslack. Have a plan. Explain that work stressors and give suggestions, and be willing to collaborate on rethinking systems so everyone feels less stretched. So, book recommendation, Trust by Hernan Diaz. Set in New York City in the Roaring Twenties, the other co-winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction brings to life the spectacular fall of the 1929 Wall Street crash. Author Diaz masterfully incorporates four different voices: Benjamin Rask, a financier who makes a fortune from the collapse; Andrew Bevel, a Wall Street tycoon; the writer, Ida Partenza, and Bevel's wife. Each viewpoint challenges the reader's understanding of the truth, creating a world that seems more real than fiction, exposing the wealthy classes and interweaving narratives. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.